Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents I Won't Shut Up, Finding Your Voice When the World Tries to Silence You, by Allie Henney. Narrated by Allie Henney. For my ancestors, to my descendants. Forward, Danielle Koch. I first came across Allie Henney and her work in a way that you probably can relate to. A witty, honest social media post about the Black experience in white America. She was responding to an incident where a Black woman's work had been stolen by a white woman, and the internet was, justifiably, in an uproar. While Allie's comedic take on the issue drew me in and had me cackling, it was her persistent pursuit of justice and her dedication to using her voice for the good of others that made me want to stick around. If there's one thing I've learned after years of being a Black woman and artist speaking out against racism on this wild internet, it's that there's no right way to do it that will keep you in the good graces of the white gaze. Whether you're shouting out against injustice in the streets through protest, or you're quietly sitting at home sharing art as a form of digital activism, you will always be too harsh, too aggressive, too intimidating, too loud for white supremacist culture. In this book, Allie doesn't just want you to face this fact. She wants you to use it as fuel. Through a collection of personal experiences, careful reflections, and unfiltered truths, Allie is setting us free. On these pages, you will find language that confirms those thoughts you've long held in the back of your mind as you've navigated a justice-focused life as a Black woman, along with a safe space to bring those thoughts out into the open. You will be given tools that you can use right away to keep honing your voice and owning your story. You will be able to rest in the fact that you're not alone and that your life has always mattered. You are about to be taken on a journey through the places that shape us. From the predominantly white spaces that try to rob us of our light, to the pews where we are taught that we better let that light shine, Allie reminds us that we are always worthy, even when the winds of white supremacy seek to blow us out. Here, you won't need to be resilient or strong, but you will need to be brave. Be brave enough to believe that the voices who say you are too much or not enough do not get the last word. You don't have to shrink or edit yourself for, as Allie puts it, Dwight man. Your voice has unimaginable power, and you have every right to use it. This book will show you how. Allie's words are bold, empowering, and necessary. She is loud on purpose, and through sharing her story with us, she's equipping us to be the same, without apology. As long as racism rears its ugly head in our culture, it will continuously require bold opposition. Rise to the occasion. Never shut up. Author's note. This book is a work of nonfiction, but it is neither an autobiography, encyclopedia entry, newspaper article, nor courtroom transcript. I've tried to retell the life events contained in this book to the best of my recollection, calling upon old journals, correspondence, and other personal writings to help give me an accurate, if not always precise, account of what happened. In some instances, I've changed names and other identifying information in order to maintain privacy or for narrative clarity. In other instances, I retained names and identifying information so that my work doesn't feel like I'm talking about someone else's life. Occasionally, I combine two or more people, incidents, and/or events to streamline the narrative. I try to be truthful in everything shared within this book's pages, even when those truths hurt. As I've written this work, I've tried to prioritize intersectional equity by taking into account various minoritized histories and experiences, and I've tried to use inclusive language. In order for this work to also be readable, I took some shortcuts with language so that my larger point would not get bogged down. There are times when I use Black, Black people, or Black folks, where some iteration of the phrase people of color could also fit. Please know that the spirit of this work is inclusivity, even in places where my language isn't as inclusive as it could be. Additionally, I come to this work as a Black, straight, cisgender, gender role non-compliant, relatively able-bodied, except for these ankles and knees, Jesus, country-born, city-dwelling, mid-Atlantic informed, Midwest raised, geriatric millennial Christian woman, and with all the privileges and shortcomings that might accompany those identities and perspectives. I have attempted to do the work of pulling universal truths from my experiences while also attempting to speak to an audience with unique yet overlapping experiences. I don't claim to have done this well, but I gave it my best shot. Finally, I want to acknowledge and honor the fact that many, if not most, of my listeners do not share my Christian spirituality. I want to say up front that the bulk of my adult life and work experience up to this point have been in the Christian church, and so it is an unavoidable fact that parts of my story would be set there. With that said, the church is merely a setting. The truths and wisdom that I pull from the harm I experienced in the white Christian church are for anyone who wants to be free from racism. Any references to spirituality are for narrative or illustrative purposes. I'm not trying to convert you to Christianity. I hope that this work invites you in and creates space for you to ask questions, wrestle with hard truths, and experience the beauty of healing and liberation. Overture, Confessions of a Loud Black Woman. I am a loud Black woman. All of these things are outside of my control, yet I have grappled with each of them in some way for as long as I can remember. I am a loud Black woman. I am loud. I am Black. I am a woman. Loud Black woman. Each of these identities has been under attack my whole life. Proclaiming my loudness, my Blackness, and my womanness is an act of defiance and resistance. The world continuously tells Black women who we are as if we don't know ourselves. They weaponize our attributes against us, taking the things we celebrate about ourselves and twisting them into something unrecognizable, undesirable, and inadequate. When we are witty, they tell us that we are crass or insubordinate. When we display self-confidence, they tell us we are domineering. When we emote, we are told that we are exaggerating, angry, or, even worse, threatening. I refuse to allow the world to force its harsh, dishonest, and out-of-touch definitions on me, which is why I am determined to tell this world exactly who I am. By telling the world who I am, I aim to defy the stereotypes and limitations that society has tried to place on me individually and on Black women collectively. Engaging in self-definition is how I resist the lies that society has tried to tell on loud Black women. I am a loud Black woman. Loudness, Blackness, and womanness are considered repulsive by the dominant white male culture. White, straight, cisgender men have made themselves the gold standard, and it is they who dictate how and whether others get to exist in this world. People who hold contested identities regularly find themselves at odds with power structures and systems that were not constructed for their flourishing. These systems are rarely concerned with anything other than protecting and maintaining the status quo of white male dominance. Marginalized folks are expected to act in accordance with this system without resisting. They must push down every part of themselves that doesn't conform to the dictates of the dominant culture. Living in such a world means that it took me a long time to fully own my identity, particularly the loud part. Society is cruel to Black people, and it doles out a special kind of punishment to loud Black people. We can't do ordinary stuff like have a cookout or hang out with our friends without white people hovering over us and trying to place limits on how we express and entertain ourselves. Our mere presence in a space is often all that is needed for us to be perceived as a threat or causing a disturbance, our actual volume notwithstanding. When white people believe that we are disrupting their sense of comfort, which they interpret as us creating a disturbance or posing some type of threat, they try to police us. When we fail to comply with their intrusive attempts to control us and jump Jim Crow, they will call the actual police to put us in our place. The Barbecue Becky incident is the perfect example of this kind of behavior. In 2018, a white woman named Jennifer Schulte, a.k.a. Barbecue Becky, called the cops on a group of Black people for having a cookout in a park in Oakland, California, because they were using charcoal in an area that had recently been made off-limits to charcoal grilling. Instead of finding a park ranger, or better yet, minding her business, Barbecue Becky resorted to calling 911. Of all the actual emergencies that she could have used William Shatner's 3-digit hotline for, she chose to call it on some Negroes who were barbecuing in a park on a sunny day. One might think that, being in California, Schulte was simply concerned that the charcoal could have sparked a wildfire. Considering California's recent history with fires, one might even be inclined to view her actions as heroic. However, a quick listen to the recordings of Schulte's 911 calls during the incident should be enough to show it ain't that deep. Although Schulte said she was concerned that the coals from the barbecue grill could burn more children, her ultimate motivation was to ensure that her and her fellow gentrifiers' taxes didn't go up. Her concern for kids only extended as far as their protection meant that she didn't have to pay more money in taxes. Put more directly, she was full of crap and gave a full of crap explanation to justify her racist actions. A frequent and reliable tactic of toxic whiteness is to use protecting the children and not wanting higher taxes as an excuse for racist behavior. White women are particularly adept at using their concern, outrage, and tears as cover for racial wrongdoing and violence. If Barbecue Becky was actually concerned about the untold danger that used charcoal briquettes posed on society, she could have contacted a park ranger, the fire department, or Smokey the Bear to help her keep her taxes low. Instead, she chose to call the cops not once, but twice, and spend 2 hours surveilling Black men who were doing nothing more than attempting to have a relaxing time at a public park. Barbecue Becky wasn't out here trying to protect the earth, the children, or even her tax rate. She was doing what white people have tried to do for half a millennium. Exercise authority and control over Black people who are doing nothing more than trying to live. When she was met with resistance, she attempted to flip the script and make on like she was the victim, a tactic that is frequently employed by white women seeking to exert power over Black people. Barbecue Becky is proof that being Black and loud in public often draws the voyeuristic eye of white folks who deem themselves to be morally superior and are determined to find a way to shut you up. They will fight, lie, and even fake cry to make sure that you regret the moment you realize that all you have to do in this world is stay Black and die. Sometimes shutting you up means making an unnecessary call to the cops. Other times, it means deciding to take matters into their own hands, which can have a fatal outcome. For Jordan Davis, a 17-year-old boy from Florida, being shut up meant taking several bullets to the chest for listening to loud music. A white man got upset that a group of black teenagers dared to hang out in a convenience store parking lot, bumping music that he disliked at a volume that he determined was too loud. That white man was sentenced to life in prison. Jordan's parents no longer have their child. Being black and loud can cost you your life. Jordan Davis's murder, Barbecue Becky, and dozens of similar incidents are exactly why I'm not about to let white supremacy tell me that I'm too loud. I refuse to accept that I need to tone down my rhetoric or shut up. I will not let white supremacy tell my people that we deserve to be harassed, jailed, or killed because our existence makes white people feel uncomfortable. Black people have the right to exist and to take up at least as much space as everybody else. We shouldn't have to adjust ourselves beyond what is required for being a compassionate, ethical person. We shouldn't have to censor, filter, and regulate ourselves while doing ordinary things. We shouldn't have to be afraid that doing everyday stuff might make some white person angry or scared for their lives, and so we end up in prison or dead. A frustrating aspect of white supremacy is that black people not only have to deal with the white supremacy inflicted on us by white people, but we must also be concerned with other black folks' internalized white supremacy and anti-blackness. Respectability politics is one of the main ways that white supremacy shows up when we're amongst ourselves. Respectability politics is the belief that people from a minority group will experience less oppression if they behave in a way that is pleasing to the dominant group, which usually means attempting to imitate the dominant group's ways. Black people must also cope with white supremacy and anti-blackness from other racial and ethnic groups. When promoted by non-black people, respectability politics results in lateral oppression, that is, the harm that marginalized groups enact on one another. In the hands of non-black people of color, respectability politics becomes a means to reinforce the racial hierarchy that frequently places black people at the bottom. Respectability politics tells us to tuck ourselves in and pull our pants up so that white people will treat us with respect and basic human dignity. It tells us that our worth is determined by our level of education, our ability to speak with good diction, our appearance, and even our ability to avoid being loud. The fear of harm from white people is real, and respectability politics is a misguided and maladaptive attempt to stay the hand of white wrath. Respectability is a tool of white supremacy because it assumes the inferiority of black people, our ways, and our culture. The black community has always had folks, including some of the ancestors, who were heavily invested in the notion that assimilation is the key to freedom. We have always had people who connected our oppression to a failure to present ourselves to white people in an acceptable manner. It's more than having different preferences from the mainstream of black culture. Engaging in respectability politics involves intentionally distancing oneself from things associated with blackness out of the misguided assumption that black people and our culture need fixing or refinement. While these ideas may have served some of our ancestors' clear and present need for survival, they have done very little for the long-term flourishing of the black community. To be clear, I give the ancestors all of their roses for the work that they did for us. I would not be writing this book if it weren't for the sacrifices of women like Ida B. Wells, Fannie Lou Hamer, and my personal hero, Ella Baker. Not all the ancestors were down with respectability politics. The women I just mentioned weren't. But the influence of respectability politics on our discourse and freedom-seeking efforts is undeniable. The ancestors did what they felt they had to do in order to survive in their time. Adhering to the politics of respectability was one of those things. We can celebrate our ancestors' accomplishments while also acknowledging the long-term negative impact that some of their ideas have had on our community. It is important for those of us who are alive in this day and age to recognize just how messed up it was that our ancestors had to demonstrate their humanity to white people by attempting to act like them. Respectability politics is a tool of white supremacy, and we should want no part of it. We can't be out here doing the work of white supremacy as if we aren't still contending with actual white supremacists. Sadly, there are some Black people who are intent on doing the work of white supremacy because they are not yet free enough to see that respectability is a concept that doesn't deliver what it promises. Everybody has a journey that they must walk of liberating themselves from white supremacy and internalized racism. Fighting for freedom means fighting for people who don't yet realize that they need to be free. Respectability politics don't save us. Being a professor at Harvard didn't save Henry Louis Gates from having the cops called on him when he tried to get into his own house. Being rich didn't stop someone from telling Oprah that she couldn't look at a handbag. Being a worship leader at a church didn't save Botham Jean from being shot to death in his own apartment. Being a Sig Roe didn't stop Sandra Bland from dying in jail after getting picked up for a traffic offense. Being a football player at an HBCU didn't stop the cops from shooting Jonathan Farrell 12 times. Respectability politics won't save us. What respectability does is steal from us. It steals our esteem for who we are as Black people and replaces it with a sense of shame. It makes us ashamed of our communities. It makes us ashamed of our vernacular. It makes us ashamed of our culture, the food, art, beliefs, and everything else that makes Blackness unique. It makes us ashamed of any aspect of our culture that doesn't jibe with the mandates of whiteness. It even makes us ashamed of one another. One of the first things that respectability politicians will say about other Black folks is that they are loud, and they will make sure that everybody knows that they prefer to carry themselves in a more dignified manner. They will express disdain for certain Black celebrities they say are loud. They won't watch certain Black shows or listen to certain types of Black music because they associate them with loudness. They won't dress in certain clothing styles because they are too loud. Respectability politics usually defines loudness as any attribute, attitude, or action that is not carried out in a subdued or understated manner. On this wise, loudness isn't necessarily determined by volume, though volume is a part of what is considered loud. Loudness, essentially, is drawing attention to oneself by breaking certain social norms. There is a strong element of subjectivity to loudness. What is deemed loud in one setting is not necessarily considered loud in other circumstances. Social class, education, and geographic location often determine what people might deem loud. Generally, what people call loud is considered loud because it trends away from what is considered normal by the dominant white culture. It is no small coincidence that what respectability politics tells us is loud is also what is looked down upon by white society. White society takes issue with loudness. In white culture, loudness is associated with being uncouth, which is why virtually any place that white culture esteems as a paragon of sophistication and taste is quiet, if not totally silent. Museums, orchestra concerts, theater production, and high-end restaurants are just a few of the places where white culture demands restraint, if not absolute silence, from its patrons. White culture associates loudness with being uneducated, uncultured, and poor. This is why a lot of white comedians, especially those of the blue-collar variety, are loud and bawdy. By embracing the speaking volume of the working class, they push the aesthetic boundaries of whiteness. It's not that loud white people don't exist, because they do, But being a loud white person is not seen so much as a problem to be eliminated as it is an attribute in need of refinement. The behavior of loud whites is rarely regulated and is often seen as a negligible quality of a group of people who carry a certain provincial charm. In other words, whiteness confers the privilege of loudness on poor white people. Poor white people get to be loud because their whiteness shields them from being seen as a threat, and, if anything, their loudness is viewed as an endearing quality that comes with their social status. White loudness is non-threatening and entertaining to other white people. And if there is anything that middle and upper class white people love, it is to be entertained by working class white folks. They enjoy laughing at the expense of poor white people almost as much as they love being entertained by black people. Middle class white people get to laugh and be entertained by the loud poor white folks. The poor white folks get to feel seen by society, all the while laughing at themselves to keep from crying about their marginalized status in the white power structure. The one shred of hope, the singular bone that the white bourgeois throws to poor white people is that, if they maintain white solidarity, they will never be treated as badly as black, indigenous, and brown folks. A sordid detail of the whiteness conspiracy is that poor whites have always been eager to trade their dignity for a semblance of power over people of color. It was poor white people who were the overseers and enforcers on the plantation during slavery. It was poor white people who carried out America's colonization agenda that led to the genocide of indigenous peoples. And it was poor white people who seemed to be the most stirred up about brown people immigrating to the United States from other parts of the world after September 11, 2001, and who chanted, "Build the wall," during the 2016 election cycle. White people can keep their loudness as long as it serves the purposes of whiteness and follows its dictates. Everyone else must shut up or be shut up. I refuse to let white supremacy shut me up. I am a loud black woman. You don't have to allow white supremacy to shut you up either. You have permission to be as loud as you want to. When we claim our loudness, we flout the standards that the dominant culture tries to impose upon people who are loud, particularly and especially loud black women. Being black comes with the assumption that you are being loud no matter what your actual volume is. Beyond one speaking volume, loudness is drawing more attention or taking up more space than white people, or black folks who are doing the work of white supremacy, think you should. Natural hairstyles are loud. Wigs and weaves are loud. Long fingernails are loud. Curvy hips and a full bosom are loud. Speaking slang is loud. Speaking standard English is loud. Wearing a dashiki is loud. Wearing high heels is loud. Being athletic is loud. Being fat is loud. Having a GED is loud. Having a PhD is loud. Being on welfare is loud. Making six figures is loud. Existing is loud. It seems like no matter what black women do, whatever our choices are, we are seen as loud. And our loudness is perceived as anger, whether we're actually angry or not. Whiteness uses black women's anger against us as a way to disqualify and discredit us because the dominant culture can only hear those who speak in syrupy sweet tones. And since our very existence has been labeled as loud and angry, our very existence is also thoroughly discredited and disqualified. Therefore, black women must shut up or be shut up. Black women are told to shut up because our existence in this world loudly testifies that no one should be forced to fit inside of other people's boxes. Try as we might, our bodies do not easily bend to white standards of beauty. As much as our bodies refuse to bend to white norms, our spirits also refuse to be broken by them. We are the daughters of women.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?